Ladies and gentlemen, please keep eating, but we should move the proceedings along. Again, my name is Michael Grieve. I'm with the American Enterprise Institute. If you've been here throughout, you've probably had just about enough of me now, and I promise you I will disappear after the following announcements, but it's my distinct honor and privilege to introduce my friend Judge William Pryor of the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. Before I do so, a few more announcements. Judge Pryor will take two or three questions after his talk. We will then immediately, without a break, proceed to the final panel of this conference, which will be moderated by Ashley Parrish, dear friend of AEI's, and a partner with the law firm of Kirkland & Ellis here in Washington, D.C. Judge Pryor and I have known each other for many, many years now, what seems to be an eternity, and I will not disclose all our youthful indiscretions, least of all his. Judge Pryor graduated from the University of Alabama, from Tulane Law School. He clerked for the distinguished and celebrated Judge John Minor Wisdom. He was the Attorney General for the state of Alabama from 1997 to 2004. When he was appointed by President Bush to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, and he has served on that circuit ever since. I want to say a few words about Judge Pryor's career as Attorney General, having earlier ranted against this state's categorically. I should now qualify that what usually transpired in federalism litigation and in federalism disputes over those years was 49 states, led then by client number 10, against one state, led by Judge Pryor. In many, many briefs and many, many controversies, what Judge Pryor did in those cases was not to articulate the idiosyncratic preferences of his state, but to lay out very carefully the general principles of federalism that ought to guide the law in these areas. This was true of the litigation over the Violence Against Women Act. This was true of a long-standing or long-running battle over the so-called multi-state agreement, over tobacco litigation, where Judge Pryor, then General Pryor, forcefully articulated the applicable federalism principles that everybody else had forgotten in a series of law review articles and articles in the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere. I'm proud to say, or I'm pleased to announce that General Pryor managed to institutionalize these principles to a considerable extent in the Attorney General's office in Alabama. I mentioned Kevin Newsom, the Solicitor General, earlier in connection with the Raich case. Solicitor General Newsom was a General Pryor hire at the AG's office in Alabama. Judge Pryor will speak. He will, towards the end, take a few questions. There will be a microphone. As usual, please announce your name and affiliation prior to asking a question, as distinct from delivering a speech. And please, we're very, very honored and very, very grateful for having Judge Pryor speak to us. Please join me in extending a very warm welcome to him.
Good afternoon. It's great to be back in our nation's capital, to be with a lot of friends, many of whom haven't seen in a while, and I appreciate you being here today. I appreciate particularly the opportunity to see my friend Michael Greva, and I thank him for his warm introduction. In the months following the terrorist attack on September 11, 2001, some legal commentators suggested that the attack had made federalism obsolete. One of those commentators, Linda Greenhouse, the longtime reporter of the New York Times regarding news at the Supreme Court, recently repeated that perspective in a farewell essay published on her retirement. Greenhouse wrote, "But then 9/11 happened, and the national mood changed. Suddenly, the federal government looked useful, even necessary. The Supreme Court's federalism revolution had been overtaken by events." Notwithstanding Ms. Greenhouse's writing of an obituary, the reports of the death of federalism, to paraphrase Mark Twain, are greatly exaggerated. The decisions of the Supreme Court last term in Medellin versus Texas and Riley versus Kennedy established that controversies about federalism have not disappeared from the docket, and in both cases, the state successfully challenged exercises of federal power. A wealth of recent scholarship also suggests that federalism remains a hot topic. Federalism is still alive and well. The real question for the future is not whether we will still respect something called federalism. We will. The question is, how will we define federalism? Is federalism about states' rights, as championed by John Calhoun in the 19th century and segregationists in the 20th century? Is federalism about the cooperative structure of our post-New Deal federal and state governments? Or is real federalism, as Michael Greva calls it, something altogether different? Underlying this debate is another more fundamental question. Is federalism a structural restraint of government? Earlier this year, Erwin Chemerinsky, one of the leading liberals of the Law Academy, published a new book, Empowering Government, Federalism for the 21st Century, that challenges the conventional perspective of federalism as a structural restraint of government. Chemerinsky offers an alternative perspective. He argues that federalism should empower, not limit, all levels of government. Chemerinsky's perspective of federalism as empowerment is radical. It is wrong. It is contrary to almost everything we know and have always known about federalism and our Constitution. And although Chemerinsky presents his perspective as novel, its error is ancient. To explain why Chemerinsky's perspective is wrong, I will address three questions. First, what is federalism? Second, why did Chemerinsky's criticisms of federalism fail? Third, why is Chemerinsky's alternative perspective of federalism as empowerment a flawed parchment guarantee of liberty? 6 years ago, in the aftermath of the victory by my former office in University of Alabama versus Garrett, I published an essay about the judicial enforcement of federalism as one part of the double security of freedom predicted by James Madison in The Federalist Number 51. Madison described the structure of the Constitution this way: in a single republic, all the power surrendered by the people is submitted to the administration of a single government, and the usurpations are guarded against by a division of the government into distinct and separate departments. In the compound Republic of America, the power surrendered by the people is first divided between two distinct governments, and then the portion allotted to each subdivided among distinct and separated departments. Hence, a double security arises to the rights of the people. The different governments will control each other at the same time that each will be controlled by itself. Madison viewed the structural restraints of federalism and the separation of powers as the double security of liberty, horizontally each level of government, state and federal, checks its abuses of power. Vertically, each government checks the other. The Federalist vision is that government is necessary but must be limited. This vision is based on the perspective that the state exists to preserve freedom. Nowhere is the Federalist perspective and support for structural restraints more evident than in Alexander Hamilton's argument in the Federalist No. 84, that a Bill of Rights was not only unnecessary in the proposed Constitution, but would even be dangerous. Hamilton argued that a Bill of Rights would contain various exceptions to powers not granted, and on this very account would afford a colorable pretext to claim more than were granted. For why declare that things shall not be done which there is no power to do? The Federalist argument was that the structural features of our Constitution provide the better guarantee for protecting our rights. The Federalist perspective informs our modern understanding of competitive federalism and how it protects our freedom in four ways. First, federalism recognizes that there is no free lunch. When a government adopts a policy to benefit someone, there is always a cost to someone else, especially when the someone else is a taxpayer. Federalism restrains the impulses of democracy so that when the government acts, its benefits will outweigh its costs. Second, there are opportunity costs in government. When the federal government addresses a problem that the states are supposed to resolve, the federal government may either fail to address a problem that the states are unable to resolve or fail to remedy an abuse by the states. Federalism, as Madison foresaw in the Federalist No. 10, creates national constituencies to address national interests and leaves local constituencies to address local interests. Third, in our federal republic, governments compete with each other. They develop policies that allow citizens to vote with their feet by moving to whichever jurisdiction provides the greater benefits of government at lower cost. As Professors John McGinnis and Ilya Soman have stated, the literature on interstate competition is vast, and its benefits is vast. Federalism creates the market for that well-documented competition. Fourth, federalism is itself a counter-majoritarian right. As the Bill of Rights protects individuals from abuses by the majority, federalism protects communities of people from abuses by a national majority. Federalism's accommodation of diverse preferences can ease racial, ethnic, religious, and ideological conflicts by allowing each of the opposing groups to control policy in its own region. In his new book, Dean Chemerinsky criticizes federalism by taking on some of its traditional formulations. That is, whether federalism reduces the likelihood of federal tyranny, enhances democratic rule, allows experimentation, and protects liberty. For each proposition, Chemerinsky contends that federalism fails the test. He describes federalism instead as rights regressive. Chemerinsky argues to the extent that federal authority is used to advance rights and equality, such as through the Religious Freedom Restoration Act or the Violence Against Women Act or the Age Discrimination and Employment Act, it is perverse to justify restricting federal power on the grounds that it inherently risks tyranny. Chemerinsky fails to defend this proposition. He views it as self-evident. He asserts, for example, it is impossible for me to understand why a federal law that forces states to clean up nuclear waste, the issue in New York versus United States, increases in the slightest the chances of a tyrannical government. Chemerinsky ignores basic notions of competitive federalism. He fails to acknowledge that federal legislation creating rights, such as the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and the Age Discrimination and Employment Act, increase costs and burdens for states and their citizens. Federal laws lead to higher litigation and compliance costs. They limit the flexibility of states to balance the benefits and costs of solutions to problems. Consider a real-world example of weighing the benefits and costs of a federal law. When I was a state attorney general, I successfully campaigned for an amendment to the state constitution that imposed the restrictions of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act on our state after those federal restrictions had been declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in City of Bernie versus Flores. The people of Alabama respect the importance of religious freedom and are willing to pay higher costs for its protection. In our state, the legitimate complaints of historic preservationists who championed strict zoning ordinances against expanding churches, for example, were considered and rejected. So too were the concerns of prison officials who legitimately feared the cost of frivolous lawsuits by inmates. But in other states, the response has been different. Many other states have not imposed on themselves the stronger protections for religious freedom. Does that mean those states are rights regressive, as Chemerinsky contends, or does it mean that other states weigh the costs and benefits of those kinds of laws differently? The question answers itself. Chemerinsky's argument that federalism is rights regressive is also myopic. Federalism, after all, has allowed the state of California and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts to grant marriage licenses to same-sex couples. If Congress were to enact a federal ban of same-sex marriage, would Dean Chemerinsky consider it to be rights regressive for the Supreme Court to rule that a federal ban violates the structural restraint of federalism? Chemerinsky's criticism of the notion that federalism reduces federal tyranny also ignores, reveals an ignorance of regulatory failure. He assumes that a federal law that is supposed to force states to clean up nuclear waste will always work. He offers no explanation for the response to the tyranny of a law that fails because of a structural error. Federalism promotes accountability. If a federal law that supposedly forces states to clean up nuclear waste does not work, then citizens are left to wonder which government is responsible for the regulatory failure. Is it the federal government that passed the buck to the states, or is it the states that enacted laws forced by the federal government? Federalism ensures that the government that wants to address a problem like the cleanup of nuclear waste has to be held accountable by the voters of that government when its law fails. Only then can laws be amended and made to work. Federalism also avoids the worst consequences of a national law gone bad. When the states are allowed to experiment, regulatory failures can be confined to smaller communities and contrasted with regulatory successes. A regulatory failure on a national scale, instead of a failure confined to a state, reveals the risk of tyranny that federalism prevents. Chemerinsky belittles the notion that federalism enhances democratic rule. He asserts that federalism has been invoked by the Supreme Court to invalidate very popular laws that clearly were responsive to the public's desires. He contends that the higher turnout of voters in national elections in contrast with local elections suggests that the federal government is the more trustworthy barometer of popular will. This criticism fails for at least three reasons. First, many of the federal laws that have been at issue in decisions of the Supreme Court about federalism have been copycats of state laws. When my office successfully argued that Congress lacked the authority to subject states to liability for money damages for disability and age discrimination, we revealed in appendices to our briefs that the states had already enacted laws against and provided remedies for those forms of discrimination before Congress enacted its one-size-fits-all solution. The federal government perhaps needed to combat those forms of discrimination in the national marketplace, but it was clearly the less responsive level of government in tackling the problem of state discrimination. My former office made the same argument against the Violence Against Women Act. Every state in the union provided civil remedies for violence before Congress enacted one. Second, the lower turnout of voters in local election that Chemerinsky cites can be attributed to rational ignorance and complacency. It does not mean that the federal government better represents popular will. Voters are less likely to flock to the polls to vote in a state or municipal election on the one hand because the choices are not as extreme. Both local office holders and their challengers are more in line with voter sentiments than in national elections. Local candidates appreciate and respect the core values of the community. A Democratic candidate in Alabama is often more conservative than even a Republican candidate in Rhode Island. Local officials know, too, that their voters can vote with their feet by moving to another jurisdiction. Ask officials of jurisdictions in the Rust Belt with higher taxes, for example, about their competition from jurisdictions in the Sun Belt with lower taxes. In national elections, on the other hand, voters know that the danger of government abuse is greater and the alternative candidates are more likely to propose solutions that contrast sharply. The option of international relocation is also not nearly as attractive to American voters as interstate relocation. There is likely a higher turnout in national elections because we cannot afford to make a grave mistake in selecting national leaders who defend our republic in a dangerous world. Chemerinsky does not acknowledge the recent scholarship about voter ignorance that challenges the conventional wisdom that individual rights are more in need of judicial protection than the structural Constitution. McGinnis and Soman have argued that voters are more likely to be interested in restoring the original settlement on civil liberties than in reviving the original constitutional structure. They have written, from the perspective of rational ignorance theory, judicial review may be more necessary to restrain government agents from violating the Constitution's structural provisions than provisions relating to individual rights. Third, although Chemerinsky describes some unconstitutional laws as very popular, what is popular somewhere is often unpopular somewhere else. Protecting religious freedom more strictly than the First Amendment requires is an easier sell in, for example, Alabama, than perhaps Nevada. Federalism recognizes that democratic values can legitimately vary by community. Chemerinsky contends that the supposed attraction of federalism and allowing states to experiment is a false hope. He asks, does anyone really believe that states should be able to experiment with not cleaning up nuclear waste in their midst, or with allowing children to bring guns near schools, or with tabling an adequate remedy for women who are victims of gender-motivated violence? Chemerinsky thinks not, but again, there are obvious rebuttals to his argument. If states are in the best position to resolve a problem like the cleanup of nuclear waste, then experimentation is a great idea. States can learn from one another what works and does not. When I propose laws as a state attorney general, I often survey the laws of other states to learn what worked and what policy would best suit my state. After studying the presumptive sentencing guidelines in some states and the voluntary sentencing guidelines in Virginia, I lobbied our legislature to adopt voluntary guidelines. I know from experience that state competition and experimentation is a real and beneficial phenomenon. Federalism, too, recognizes the inevitability of diverse opinions. Several states allow widespread ownership of and possession of firearms, even though Dean Chemerinsky might find that policy impossible to understand. If a state adopts a policy that Dean Chemerinsky fails to understand, and the policy works, other states will surely follow, no matter what the dean thinks. After all, we know that some law school deans thought it was a great idea to discriminate against the military recruiters in their on-campus interviews, until some states, and then Congress, adopted a more popular policy. Sometimes it is best to ask whether federal power is the source of a problem instead of the answer to it. Many of the difficulties that states face in combating problems like violence against women have been exacerbated by uses of federal power that Chemerinsky otherwise applauds. State efforts to combat root causes, such as Pornography and nude dancing, which treat women as sex objects, have been stymied at times by decisions of the federal judiciary that enforce the Bill of Rights. There is little evidence that states are unwilling to combat violent crime. Chemerinsky fails to appreciate the concept of opportunity cost. When Congress behaves like a state legislature and spends resources to address problems that have already been addressed by the states, then the federal government fails to study and solve problems that the states are literally powerless to address. The Constitution created the federal government to protect national security, conduct foreign affairs, and promote economic competition because the states are not up to those tasks. Whenever the federal government usurps the power of the states, it necessarily diverts its attention from its national responsibilities. Chemerinsky's failure to appreciate the virtues of American federalism as a structural restraint leads him instead to propose an alternative perspective of government run amok that he calls federalism as empowerment. His book is aptly entitled Empowering Government. That is exactly what he has in mind. Chemerinsky posits the central thesis of federalism as empowerment is the genius, modest, isn't he, of having multiple levels of government. He asserts if one level of government fails, another is there to take over responsibility. In other words, the more government, the merrier. Chemerinsky asserts that his federalism as empowerment has four characteristics. First, sovereign immunity should be abolished. Forget about limiting the cost of government. Second, Congress should have virtually unlimited authority to regulate. Forget about the limits of enumerated powers. Third, the jurisdiction of the federal judiciary should be expansive. Forget about the least dangerous branch. Fourth, states should have broad authority to supplement the regulations enacted by Congress. Forget about enforcement of the Supremacy Clause to remove barriers of state protectionism and the abuses of compound regulation. Chemerinsky contends that we should discard sovereign immunity because it is, in his words, quote, inconsistent with the U.S. Constitution. He argues nowhere does the document mention or even imply that governments have complete immunity from suits. He asserts sovereign immunity is inconsistent with a central maximum of American government, that no one, not even the government, is above the law. Chemerinsky advances his argument with a bit of historical revisionism. He explains that anti-federalists George Mason and Patrick Henry argued that Article III would override state sovereignty, and some federalists agreed. He then concedes that prominent federalists, notably Alexander Hamilton and James Madison, argued that the states would retain their sovereign immunity. He then asserts this recounting of the ratification debates reveals that there was no consensus, even among the Constitution supporters, about whether state sovereign immunity survived Article III. This reasoning is supposed to support Chemerinsky's argument that sovereign immunity is inconsistent with the Constitution. Chemerinsky's conclusion does not follow. The ratification debates evidence that there was a disagreement about whether the Constitution should expressly provide that sovereign immunity survived, but Chemerinsky's view that sovereign immunity should not survive was a minority position. The anti-federalist, of course, criticized the proposed Constitution for its lack of an express guarantee of sovereign immunity. Madison and Hamilton represented the majority view of federalists, that sovereign immunity remained unaffected, and the quick ratification of the 11th Amendment later established that sovereign immunity, in at least some form, clearly had survived. Chemerinsky's argument that sovereign immunity is inconsistent with the maxim that no one is above the law is baseless. The government is not a person. An official of the government is. When we say we have a government of laws, not men, we are not suggesting anything about whether we should expose the state treasury to unlimited liability. The government, in the American experience, is not an individual, but the creature of the collective we the people. Sovereign immunity allows the people, through their union, to establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, and provide for the common defense. But the American experience has always recognized that sovereign immunity is necessary to protect some operations of government. Chemerinsky does not explain whether any form of immunity from suit should exist. We are left to wonder whether he favors sovereign immunity for the United States. He's also unclear about whether he favors the retention of other forms of immunity, such as prosecutorial, judicial, legislative, and qualified immunity, if state sovereign immunity is inconsistent with the Constitution and the maxim that no person is above the law, as he contends, then it is difficult to understand how any form of immunity would make sense in his legal regime. Chemerinsky's proposal would make our government worse. The government would have to employ more lawyers and judges, settle dubious claims, and pay all sorts of awards of damages. Taxes would increase. Officials in all parts of the government would be harassed by lawsuits, and the government would become even less efficient. Chemerinsky argues that we should spread these costs to the taxpayers, but he offers no evidence that the taxpayers want to pick up the bill. Chemerinsky ignores the settled fact that we, the people, remain entirely free to abolish or create exceptions to sovereign immunity whenever we like. The government has always been able to consent to suit and waive its immunity. If sovereign immunity is so contrary to fundamental notions of American government, then why do our elected representatives continue to keep it? Again, the question answers itself. Chemerinsky's federalism as empowerment would also grant Congress the authority to regulate and tax virtually every aspect of American life. He asserts that the structural restraints of federalism are minimal. He would discard any judicially enforced limits of the Commerce Clause or the taxing and spending powers. He would not only allow Congress broader authority under the Civil War amendments to regulate state governments, he would also allow Congress, under the guise of the Civil War amendments, to regulate private conduct. He would cease reading the 10th Amendment as informing our understanding of state sovereignty. Chemerinsky's perspective that federalism provides a minimal restraint of government is contrary to our Constitution. The original understanding, as Madison explained, was that two structural restraints, federalism and the separation of powers, would provide a double security for less government and more freedom. The framers believed in limiting and checking, not empowering, all levels of government. Chemerinsky responds to the originalist argument with a sleight of hand by asserting that originalism cannot provide the foundation for judicial enforcement of federalism as limits. He retreats from arguing against the historical understanding of federalism as limits and challenges instead the separate, although related, proposition that federalism merits judicial enforcement. He does not offer any evidence that the original understanding was that Congress had virtually unlimited power to regulate non-economic activity and tax any aspect of American life. He instead contends that the framers did not discuss judicial review. He totally ignores, for example, the argument of Alexander Hamilton in Federalist No. 78 that the judiciary would have the authority to apply the Constitution as the supreme law and declare an unconstitutional law void. He does not acknowledge the arguments of McGinnis and Soman that the federal judiciary has comparative advantage over political actors in protecting some aspects of federalism. They argue that the judiciary cannot benefit from a federally organized cartel that insulates state officials from competition. The judiciary instead will be more motivated than elected officials, either state or federal, to enforce neutral principles that foster second-order values like federalism. Chemerinsky also asserts that the premise that less government is better is just as unjustified as the opposite assumption that government action on balance is better than government inaction. Memo to Dean Chemerinsky. The Berlin Wall fell almost 20 years ago. There is ample evidence that limited government is the better assumption. Chemerinsky also proposes significantly changing the jurisdiction of the federal judiciary. He criticizes using principles of comity to avoid friction between state and federal courts and deny the exercise of federal jurisdiction. Chemerinsky instead proposes litigant choice as empowerment. Specifically, individuals with constitutional claims should be able to choose whether to litigate in federal or state court. This argument, like so many others Chemerinsky advances, overlooks a basic understanding of economics. Chemerinsky does not account for the efficiency gained by the division of labor. Although federal and state courts decide some common issues, they resolve on most fronts different kinds of cases that arise under the laws of their respective jurisdictions. The principles of comity that delineate the jurisdiction of federal and state courts promote efficiency in decision-making. Chemerinsky's proposal would destroy the efficiency gains from this division of labor. He would allow all civil litigants to choose state or federal fora, whether by filing or removal, whenever the litigant, whether plaintiff or defendant, raises a constitutional issue. He would allow criminal defendants convicted in state courts to relitigate de novo constitutional issues in federal courts. Chemerinsky does not explain whether litigant empowerment should be applied only horizontally at the trial level. Litigants could, after all, be empowered vertically in appellate review, so that an appellant from the judgment of a federal district court could file an appeal to a state appellate court. Instead of litigant empowerment, it could be called judicial ping pong. Chemerinsky's so-called empowerment of litigants would wreak havoc on both federal and state courts. Disparate civil lawsuits would move arbitrarily between state and federal courts. The finality of criminal convictions in state courts, where the vast majority of prosecutions occur, would be undermined. Most of all, the courts, both federal and state, would struggle even more than they do now to deliver economical, swift, and predictable justice to litigants. Finally, Chemerinsky would alter our current understanding of preemption so that it would, in his words, empower states. In his view, our current law of preemption invalidates desirable laws and strikes down state statutes that advance freedom. He singles out for criticisms decisions of the Supreme Court regarding state laws about product liability, cigarette advertisements, doing business with Myanmar, insurance policy sold in Europe. Chemerinsky proposes preemption be found in only two circumstances: when a federal law expressly preempts state law, and where there is an actual conflict between federal and state law. As Michael Greva describes it, Chemerinsky's vision produces an exceedingly robust presumption against preemption. Chemerinsky's conception of advancing freedom is contrary to the traditional bias of the Constitution in favor of free trade. The constitutional perspective suggests that a judicial presumption for or against preemption should depend on the congruence of federal regulation with the core purposes of enumerated federal powers, foremost the protection of interstate commerce. Chemerinsky ignores the economic interest of producing, selling, advertising goods and services across state and national lines, free from the protectionism and compound burdens of various state laws. Chemerinsky views any sort of state laws that are intended to protect consumers as advancing freedom, but he is unconcerned about the economic interest of consumers to obtain across state lines goods and services at low prices from producers and sellers regulated by a national standard. Chemerinsky does not argue that government is without limits, but his limits are not structural. His answer to limiting government is that, quote, courts should aggressively enforce the Constitution's protection of individual and civil rights. He contends this is the primary protection against tyranny, whereas federalism-based limits on government power offer no safeguard and have actually been rights regressive. At bottom, Chemerinsky's perspective is a familiar wolf. It is exactly what Hamilton warned against in Federalist No. 84 when he described the Bill of Rights as potentially dangerous. Hamilton was right about those who depend wholly on a Bill of Rights to protect freedom, although it obviously improved the our Constitution was obviously improved by the addition of a Bill of Rights. Our Constitution would not be nearly as protective of freedom as it is today without the structural restraints that Madison described rightly as our double security. Justice Scalia recently wrote that it is a mistake to think that the Bill of Rights is the defining or even the most important feature of American democracy. He explained, virtually all the countries of the world today have a Bill of Rights. You would not feel your freedom secure in most of them. Scalia explained, they are what the framers of our Constitution called parchment guarantees, because the real constitutions of those countries, the provisions that establish the institutions of government, do not prevent the centralization of power in one man or party, thus enabling the guarantees to be ignored. Scalia rightly declared, structure is everything. For more than two centuries, the structure of our Constitution has made America the beacon for the free world. It has prevented our Bill of Rights from becoming a parchment guarantee. The structure of our Constitution, which divides sovereignty to empower states to address local problems, the federal government to address national problems, and both levels to check each other, remains an enduring gift that, true to its promise, secures the blessings of our liberty. In our post-September 11th world, where freedom is our hope, we need federalism, which secures freedom now more than ever. Both federalism and the separation of powers must endure as structural limits of government. Thank you.
Judge Pryor has generously agreed to answer a few brief questions because we must proceed. Please, when you ask your questions, bear in mind that his office imposes obligations and restrictions and restraints on Judge Pryor that the rest of us, many of us, do not labor under. Please, there's a microphone here.
Yeah, mine is just a question. It's a point of information you can clear out very quickly, or perhaps not. But I don't know of any countries that have a Bill of Rights which combines the right to trial by jury with the right to bear arms, which is a tyranny. Can you cite any?
Judge Pryor is going to answer questions about his talk, not about other countries. Yes, sir. Please wait for the microphone.
Rob Gasaway of Kirkland & Ellis. Judge Pryor, how important is practical, workable doctrines of preemption and choice of law to your success in your argument against Dean Chemerinsky? If those doctrines aren't practical and workable across a vast substantive groups of areas, does his point take on more force against you, i.e., Pryor's federalism is good in theory, but it's just not workable in practice?
Yeah, I would say that's true, and a lot of what Randy Barnett was sharing with us earlier today shows how there's been an ebb and flow that ensures some practicality in federalism. I don't think there's any doubt about that, but it's hard to understand what the practicality is for a solution that says government can do anything it wants. It's okay. Your rights will be protected because you can file lawsuits and go to court.
Sorry. Judge Pryor. Thank you very, very much. We will proceed to the next panel. Please join me in thanking Judge Pryor for a terrific talk.